Welcome to Book Notes, the Ohio Channel's conversation show featuring Ohio authors and books about Ohio. Today's guest is Amit Majmudar, Ohio's first poet laureate. He's also the first MD we've had on the show. Dr. Majmudar holds down a day job as a diagnostic nuclear radiologist in Dublin. He's published two novels, including the critically acclaimed Partitions, as well as three books of poetry, his most recent being Dothead. His poetry and prose have also been featured in such august publications as The New Yorker and The Kenyon Review. And thank you, Amit Majmudar, for joining us today. You are the first Ohio Poet Laureate.
Yes, I am. Very honored.
So what you're doing now will set precedent for poets. And I have to admit, you know, whenever I hear poet laureates, I think of like togas and laurel leaves and everything like that. So maybe you should impose that on
everybody. Oh, that would be great to have a uniform like that. But I think it's pretty much whatever, you know, come as you are.
So you follow in this long line of poets who have writers who also have day jobs. I think of Philip Larkin. Yeah. I think of T.S. Eliot, William Carlos William. You are another, you're in the medical field.
That's right, yeah.
So how do you keep control of the muse while still keeping control of your career?
Yeah, you know, for me, it's very much just a divided life. And for me, the field that I'm in is nuclear radiology. So basically what I do is I don't actually even see patients regularly. I basically go into an office in the basement of the hospital. It's a dark room. There's a bunch of really high resolution computer screens, and I read case after case after case after case, and then I go home. And so that's not the kind of medicine that really kind of sticks to you and bothers you, and you know, you have these, you know, gut-wrenching conversations with patients and, you know, going through a lot of terrible things. So for me, radiology was perfect because it was something that I could easily cordon off in my life. And what I work is basically shift work. So when my shift is over, you know, I go home, and then basically, you know, it's as if I was never there, and then all of a sudden I can just become the writer again. Of course, before that I become like dad and, you know, husband and everything, and then at night I can just be the writer.
So there's been studies now to really disprove this whole idea of this left and right brain, how the left brain used to be more mathematical, the right brain's more creative. But I think one can say that, you know, medicine and poetry are kind of, you have a very scientific technical side, and then you have this part where you're trying to create emotions and feelings and visions with words. Is there any side of that is useful to one another?
Well, I think that as our understanding of the brain progresses, we're realizing that it's really just one big network. Everything's hooked up to everything else. And you know, we talk about emotion and we talk about reason and mathematics and language, and they all have different centers in the brain, but those aren't isolated centers. They'd be useless if they were isolated. Everything is a neural network connected to everything else. And it's not for nothing that people compare the internet to a giant collective brain, you know? And I think that when it comes to poetry in particular, poetry gains a lot of its force and beauty through patterning. And pattern is basically mathematical at heart, repetition, periodicity. As a radiologist, what I do is I look at anatomy, basically, which follows a basic normal pattern. And then disease, whether it's stroke or tumor or trauma or anything like that, it basically disrupts the pattern. And that's how you know it's abnormal. And so when I write poetry, you know, I'm creating patterns in language. And so that's how I know that it's a good poem, is that it has this pattern that adds to its force. That's why it's not in prose, you know? And so I feel that, like, between, you know, the nature of the brain itself and the nature of poetry itself, there is no division. And it works best when everything's just interdigitated, interconnected.
Mm. Did you, was it the sciences first for you, or was it poetry first?
It was literature first, for sure, yeah. Having said that, science is kind of in my blood, because, you know, everyone in my immediate family is growing up was a doctor. So that was just kind of in the groundwater. You know, if you looked at my house growing up, basically, you know, the novels and the poetry and all that was just mine, but everyone else had medical journals and medical textbooks, and that was the other type of literature, medical literature, that was in the house. So in a sense, you know, I guess technically medicine came first, but really for me personally, in my own personal consciousness, it was definitely literature was, I mean, I arrived at it simultaneously with my intellectual awakening as just a, you know, a teenager even.
Was it encouraged? Did your parents like, oh, you're well, not?
They, no, they you know, there was never like that at all. I think primarily because they knew that I had a sound enough head on my shoulders that I wasn't going to try and make that career out of that. I suspect I might have gotten some pushback if I had been like, you know, mom, dad, you know, you have a great life, but I'm going to go, you know, go and become a bohemian and just try and live as a poet. So they knew that I compartmentalized it and I prioritized it accordingly, or prioritized it in the best possible way, I think, long term. And I remember when I was 17, they actually published my first book. So my first book is actually none of these books that you have here. It was this book of poems and plays that I wrote when I was 17. It was called Entrance. And we self-published it. My parents were like, you know what? We support you. We support you enough to publish this book for you.
So I'm interested, as somebody with a day job, I think that, you know, a lot of aspiring poets, artists, we'll call them artists, that they have this idea of just, you know, retiring out to New York and living this art life.
Yeah.
And then there's other folks that, like, will work a day job.
Yeah.
And live like the rest of us.
Yeah.
And then use that as their inspiration. Where would you quantify one as better than the other?
You know, that's another question that has kind of, you know, it comes up in my mind every once in a while, and it has for many years. And the way I look at it is this. Look, you know, if you want to have career advancement within literature, it's important for you to go where the networks are, and it's important for you to network. And so if you want to make a career out of that, you either should go into a university or you should go to New York City, right? Because that's where the people are. That's where the gatekeepers are. That's where the sort of influential people are. It's the best thing you can do for yourself is to go there. And I would argue that a mediocre writer has a better chance of becoming famous or getting an award or getting recognition if they enter an environment where they can make friends with the people who decide these kinds of things. And so if you are living in a flyover state, in a suburb of a mid-sized city of a flyover state, you better be really good, you know, and you cannot get by, you cannot come up being mediocre, you know what I'm saying? But that's not necessarily the case if you're in the right environment. But really, from my perspective, that's not the life that I want to live, and that's not what I value on a day-to-day basis. That's just not who I am. So I think it's more important to be true to yourself and true to your way of life than it is to chase after the very chimerical notions of fame and grandeur as a writer, because that stuff is transient. But, you know, your kids are going to live on after you, and they're going to remember who you were, and all the, whatever critics wrote, you know, review about you, they forget about you the next week when they're writing about the next writer, you know? And so I value, I think, what is important in life, and that's my family, and that's how I treat them and what kind of life I can provide for them.
Well, in getting to this, and I don't want to polarize these types of things, but it seems like poetry used to be taught. Poetry used to be, it was whenever there's a major historical event or a major event in history, there would always be a poem. There's a big part. And one can argue that in contemporary times, poetry hasn't been valued even as much as, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. Hopefully it's coming back. Some of the times I think about that, we have the academic poets that seem to write for other poets.
Okay.
And then we have poets of the everyday experience.
Okay.
And so I wonder about living the life of everyone else as opposed to living the avant-garde. If you're able to, if your voice is able to touch more people, and I don't want to disregard all the academic, the poets for poets, but in poetry you've had to come across stuff. You're like, this is very good. You need a BA or an MFA in English to understand this.
Yeah, you know, you bring up a good point, but when you said polarized, that implies two poles, right? But I think that if you look at the whole picture of, say, contemporary American poetry, it's multipolar. It's actually, I guess, not multipolar, multifocal, right? There are many different worlds within it, different regions within it, different types of poets. There are poets who have university appointments and who are professors who write very accessible stuff. So former National Poet Laureate Billy Collins. He teaches in an academic setting. You know, so there's every type of poem out there. There's stuff that I don't understand, you know, there's stuff that I think makes too much sense. Sometimes I'm kind of like Goldilocks, you know, this is too much, this is too one way. And everyone, every individual reader has their sweet spot of what they're looking for. And there are some readers who would say, look at my work and be like, this rhymes, this makes too much sense, I need it to be more fragmentary, you know. But other people would look at that and be like, this, it's too difficult for me to figure out, there's too many allusions to mythology and all this kind of stuff. So for some people, I'm too simple, for other people, I'm too difficult, but hopefully there's...
Just right.
Yeah, hopefully there's some people out there for whom I'm just right, and those are the people I'm writing for. So I'm not necessarily writing for, you know, elite academics, I'm not necessarily writing for the people, whoever they are, you know, I don't think you can even, because again, those two terms are so heterogeneous that you can't even generalize based on that. I think, you know, every reader of poetry has their poet, and hopefully I'll be the poet for some segment of the reading population. My name is Amit Majmudar. I'm reading from my new book, Dothead, and the name of this poem is TSA. Off with the wristwatch, the Reeboks, the belt. My laptop's in a bin. I dig out my keys from my jeans and do my best Midwestern grin. At O'Hare, at Atlanta, at Dallas-Fort Worth, it happens every trip. At LaGuardia, Logan, and Washington Dulles, the customary strip is never enough for a young brown male whose name comes up at random. Lest the randomness of it be doubted, observe how Myrtle searched in tandem, how Doris's six-pack of Boost has been seized, and Ethel gets the wand. How polite of the screeners to sham paranoia when what they really want is to pick out the swarthiest, scruffiest of us, and pat us top to toe. My fellow Ahmeds and my alien Alis, Muhammad, alias Mo, my buddies from med school, my doubles partners, my dark, unshaven brothers, whose names overlap with the crazies and God fiends, ourselves, the goateed other. The arms I sing. Forget the man, there is no other epic. Sing the arms of kids, the ones with pustules all along their veins, like runway track lights burning for a plane that blew up hours ago, with no survivors. The ones with runes no parent can decipher. One message knifed and scarred and knifed again in a mystic tongue forgotten who knows when. The arms imprinted with a shadow grip, as if the dad who grabbed and crushed had dipped his hand in black paint first. The arms with tight arcs of perforation, human bites, they get infected faster than a dog's. The toddler's arms, with both hands scalded raw, all glistening and hog pink, swollen taut, the tantrum over, the lesson taught to signal fires that call across a plain. The city is sacked and all the children slain.
So this was a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. 2011.
So yeah. I can't help but read this without thinking of the poet in you.
Yeah.
I would call this a beautifully brutal book, a brutally mm-hmm. beautiful book, mm-hmm. maybe. I was thinking of The Painted Bird, Jerzy Kaczynski's story.
Yeah,
like this has much more heart. Mm-hmm. I was thinking of some of these images of what was the violence going on between mm-hmm. the various factions here during the 1947 split. Or the division of Pakistan and India as a Hieronymus Bosch painting. It was just, there's horrible examples of humanity that you paint in here, mm-hmm, but you mm-hmm. coat this with this sense of humanness. Mm-hmm. Was that your approach to this? Like, why did you want to go this dark but this hopeful?
You know, I think that it all comes down to contrast, right? So if you simply paint, you know, a picture of hope and beauty and this and that, and it's almost, if it's monochromatic, it doesn't stand out. But if you create a background of intense darkness, it shines. It shines by its own light. And I think that was the approach that I had when I was writing Partitions. Everything I write tends to approach things in a different way, but I'm pretty sure if I can think back with that one, I remember that I wanted the good to shine by its own light by virtue of the darkness, the dark backdrop.
I was trying to think, like, is this a person who likes to set up the way, and it's hard not to talk about this without giving away the ending, and I don't want to do mm-hmm. that, but is it hard to, like, to figure out the circles? But I kept on getting caught, actually wonderfully caught up in your descriptive language. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. You were able to describe scenes in a way of a poet, to be cliche. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what was your favorite parts about this? Was it the scenes or was it the plot?
For me, it's really, when I think about writing that book, which was quite a while ago, the thing that stands out for me is probably neither. It's probably a sense of being given the entire book, because I wrote this whole book in like two months actually, and it just came to me, and
wow.
And that is usually something that I've only experienced with poems that only last like a, you know, page, right, or even a line. Sometimes you're like, wow, you know, that line totally just came to me, but this, I felt like the whole book came to me, and I wrote it so quickly. And I had just gotten a literary agent in New York, and he was like, I showed him the first 30 pages, and he was like, you know, whenever you finish this, I'm happy to, you know, shop this around for you. And I was like, hold that thought. And then it just came to me. The whole thing came to me. And so that's how I remember it. I don't think I necessarily think of it in terms of scenes, plot, character, this, that, the other.
So it was just this one, just burst.
It was one whole. It was one whole. Yeah.
So when you were developing your writing life, mm-hmm. Did you first identify with poetry or did you first identify with prose?
Prose, actually. I started out when I was like 11 or 12 writing spy thrillers,
Ooh.
Basically James Bond novels.
All right.
Yes. And I didn't understand copyright infringement, so I literally wrote James Bond novels and then was like shocked when they would get rejected by major New York publishing houses. But this was what I did when I was like 11 or 12, and so that's basically what I used to read a lot of, just spy thrillers. I must have churned through, you know, hundreds of them.
I had a poetry instructor once tell me that it takes a lifetime to understand, but it takes about 12 minutes to write a good poem.
Yeah.
I thought, okay, yeah. I don't know if I really totally agree with all of that. And speaking about poetry, this starts out with basically a racist kind of title.
You're right.
So,
yeah, that's true.
So, and you deal with race in here, and you deal
in the
with
beginning,
so many other things. I think there's actually even, well, you talk about the Bond.
Old I do
issue
talk
in
about,
here.
Yeah.
So,
I talk about James Bond, yeah.
What goes in your mind about, okay, this is going to be a poem, and then this is going to be a published poem?
Well, that's a question to which I don't really have an answer, because I'm kind of helter-skelter about the whole thing. I'm all over the place. Some different things will trigger a poem. Sometimes a word will trigger a poem, or just a vowel sound, or an image, or a story. It's I don't really know what's going to become a poem. And a lot of times I'll just want to rhyme in a certain way, or want to have a rhythm in a certain way. And then it just kind of finds its way into form, into a poem. And so that's a mystery that I've never really tried to figure out, in the sense that I like to keep it mysterious. I feel that if I opened up the clock face and saw all the gears, it might lose some of its mystery and charm for me. So I like not really knowing what's going on in my head, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I don't even know how a poem is going to end. I don't know what the poem is going to look like. I don't know what images are going to be in it. Sometimes I'll just put a few words together and then start patterning it off of that, and it'll look like I thought it through, but I never really thought it through. And then as far as how do I know it's going to be a published poem, you know, I just send stuff out, stuff gets rejected. Sometimes one thing will get through and I'll be like, okay, wow. So basically, I guess how I know it's going to be a published poem in a book is if I get it published in a magazine first. So every poem in there has been published in some magazine or another, some journal, some literary review or something like that. So I use the various editors at various journals and magazines as a way of vetting my own work, because, you know, I produce all sorts of stuff. Probably a lot of it's bad, some of it's good. Hopefully the various editors will be able to pick out the ones that are good.
Oh, I just think about so many writers that, you know, rejection is a curse of death, and that's...
Oh yeah, I mean they put a lot of their personal pride and sense of worth into whether or not their work gains the approval of, you know, strangers. For me, I think probably a lot of my self-worth is bound up in other things, like the things we were talking about earlier, like my roles as, say, a father, husband, son, doctor, you know. So I have a lot of, you know, things that buttress that. Mm-hmm. If all that I had was writing, and every time a poem was rejected, it was kind of a stab at my self-worth, you know, then yeah, it would probably hurt me a lot more. But for me, I just throw things out. It's just like, see what sticks, you know what I'm saying? So people reject my stuff. And the other important thing to remember is that I've been doing this for so long that I know for a fact that poems that people that end up getting published in very difficult to publish places, poems that people write me emails out of the blue about, have gotten rejected in some cases 2 or 3 times. So it's not like it's foolproof, you know? Yeah. So it's not like rejection's foolproof. And we know this for a fact. I mean, they just had an article in The Guardian about George Orwell getting a rejection letter from T.S. Eliot about Animal Farm. And it's like, you know, if George Orwell would have been like, oh God, T.S. Eliot didn't like Animal Farm, now I'm gonna just pitch this, you know, we wouldn't have Animal Farm, right? Harry Potter got rejected by a bunch of places. You know, they're all kicking themselves, right? So you can't trust rejection. Maybe that's the other thing. The other thing is that I don't trust rejection.
Huh, that's, yeah. And I'm going to draw another parallel, and we're running out of time, and I have more questions. I have a ton more questions, but I'm just thinking about how you said you don't necessarily want to see the clockworks of your own creation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a bunch of different words we can use for this, but there's a sense of magic in this book.
Oh, I hope so. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Partition. But I'm wondering if that kind of magic that controls the protagonists in here, mm-hmm, is kind of reminiscent of the same kind of magic that you're almost turning yourself over to be like, you know, this one works or doesn't, I'm inspired or I'm not, this happens.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there is a sort of, I don't want to say luck, because it's,
luck,
it's effort.
No, I think luck does play into it. Effort plays into it, and I guess natural ability plays into it, but luck also plays into it. And I'm not so proud as to say that I've never been the beneficiary of luck. Mm. You know, I feel like I've been the beneficiary of luck, both at the level of the individual line, sometimes at the level of an individual, you know, scene or image, but also luck in the sense of getting published at all, getting noticed at all. A lot of that stuff is chance and contingency and just fluke occurrences. Mm. And if you don't have luck, all your talent may go unrecognized, in my opinion.
It's fascinating. One more question here.
Yeah.
How has being an Ohioan shaped your
work? Well, you know, I don't want to generalize about either Ohioans or Midwesterners or, you know, people in other parts of the country, but I do feel that Midwesterners, and they generally have a reputation for this, is being a little bit more down to earth. And I think that if I'd been, you know, brought up in some other environment, so like say Orange County or something like that, you know, I might have a different personality, I might have a different outlook on life, but I was, you know, brought up in a suburb of the Midwest, and probably that has influenced kind of my priorities in life, probably. And then, you know, I just think Ohio, Columbus, for example, I think it's just a great place to raise a family, a great place to live. And so, I mean, I've lived in Ohio almost my whole life, and I've never wanted to go anywhere else.
That's great.
Yeah.
So before we end, we have some our little speed round here. I got
four questions
for you.
All right.
So are you a computer or a notepad?
Computer.
Writer? Computer.
Yes.
Where's your favorite place to write?
In my study, in my house.
What are you reading right now?
Crowds in Power by Eliash Kanetti and The True Believer, Reflections on the Rise of Mass Movements by Eric Hoffer.
And then what would the Amit now say to the younger Amit as a writer?
Just keep doing what you're doing. You're making a lot of mistakes, but you need to make those mistakes in order to do things right later on. So just stay the course.
Thank you for your time. It's been an honor to talk with Ohio's first poet laureate.
Thank you very much.
And the great thing is that not only do we have other books to look forward to here soon?
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, I'm always staying busy, so you'll see something else.
But we can see stuff right now. We've got your books already published. And Kenyon Review.
Mm-hmm.
Been in the New Yorker.
That's right.
You've been in some other smaller magazines.
No, they're all great. Yeah, yeah.
So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.